The next is part from top of page 43 in the old index, right there by the sacred river, where the sick were waiting to die and the dead to be burned. There was an awful lot of sexuality next to the burning logs of the funeral pyres, immediately alongside the waters of the most holy of Indian rivers. The prostitutes had their symbolic temples. I really mean temples, for many temples, and not only those dedicated to procreation, are embellished with illustrations of carnal love with rank as religious art. The most intimate, indecent is perhaps the better word. Positions are graphically highlighted on the walls of those temples. The message of carnal love, creativity is, I suppose, the correct realism that blossoms forth from a thousand religious statues, from a thousand religious frescoes. But it is the act of sex, not of love, that is symbolized. Sophisticated societies use all manner of illogical phrases for the emotion known as love. To make love is just plain stupid, for love cannot be made. It is born with a person, within the heart and soul. It is a feeling that one may or may not have. If a person is lucky enough to be born with love in his heart, then he has love for the rest of his life. Love cannot be turned into symbols and statues, nor can be made, so-called made. If you think that I'm drawing a long bow, then remind yourself of the psychopath. He's the person without feelings, without emotions, including the feeling and emotions of love. So if it is possible for there to be an absence of these qualities, then it follows that it must be possible for those without these feelings, to make love like robots. Indian brothels are, I suppose, the most smelly places of the world. They are usually located next to the temples or by the markets, and they stink to high heaven. The lover pays the record sum of 8 cents to have sexual union with a lady of pleasure. After Satura had finished all he could do at Mahababishi Kamana, he wandered in the cool of the evening dawn through Kaman. We wandered in the cool of the evening dawn, now down to the ghettos, down to the ghettos, in the holes with their open doors, dim petrol lights revealed dirty straw mats and even dirtier straw cushions. Painted wars were very much in evidence, as was all pervading stench, a vile smell compound of odor of urine, sauces, cunningly mixed species that were sold under most unhygienic conditions at street corners, and red betel nut of potato and pepper patties, a cheap perfume of decaying rats. Here in the ghettos was a fiesta of dirt, smell and sex. We watched as the excited patron of one of the ghetto's houses paid his 8 cents and passed through one of the open doors. This was immediately shut. We heard a bolt of being rammed home and a key being turned. The door is the only part of such hovels that is made of wood. The rest is cardboard and flattened tin containers. Within a minute or two, the movement of violent passion started to shake the whole flimsy structure. The waiting customers hooted with laughter. The hovel shook in one last frenzied thrust. There was a moment pause, and then the satisfied client, he was hardly more than a youth, came out of the brothel looking rather sheepish. I thought, and the first in the quenu took his place. Soon the howl started to tremble once more, to shake and then to dance. A man had taken a boy's place. All this rather sickened me. The Tsatura was not at all perturbed. He was aware that the Indians are far from being bashful where sex is concentrated, and their animal behavior was of interest to him, anthropologically indeed. I heard him comment that the Indians possessed the most interesting of all forms of native civilization. I wasn't quite certain whether or not he was referring to their mating habits or the general standards of living. In a nearby doorway in this same street, in this same stretch of the ghetto, we noticed a fat little girl. She was no more than a babe, with long black braids that came down to her shoulders. I thought she was trying to dance. Then I recognized the movements. Despite her tender years, she was trying and trying in vain, with her stubby little immature figure, to intimate the cunning body of convulsions of her professional practiced neighbors. We watched the human comedy, or should it be tragedy, for a few minutes, and then my companion hailed a passing rickshaw. "Where are we going?" I asked, for I hadn't let him take over the arrangement for the rest of the evening. "We're going to see Children of God," he replied. That was done on page 68. As page index, yes, next is The Children of God. This is probably the most pitiful of all necropolitic ceremonies in India. The rickshaw took us to a place some way from the hovels we had been visiting, but still on the bank of the river. The night sky was turned into day as we reached the very primitive crematorium. I counted more than 40 funeral fires, some so close that they were almost contiguous. The attendants are so close that the denizens are offended. As we walked round the crematorium, for all the world as though we were enjoying the attractions of some public park or place of amusement, we could see small tormented limbs dangling outside the immediate orbit of the flames until the consuming fire broke them off. The attendants snatched up the freed arms and legs and threw them back into the flames as if they were feeding a garden fire more twigs. It was a sickening experience to see the small lacerated faces, the thin black emaciated bodies, the burning sightless eyes staring into the night sky. Life to these children had meant nothing but suffering and despair. What else could have been expected in a country afflicted by poverty and starvation, set in a world riddled by fear, hate, and war? These are the reasons why nameless children are burnt at night beside the majestic Indian River. That is why the faces of the children, twisted and so contorted by the scaring flames, seem to be crying and not crying. I was glad that Siti was not with us to see the end product of man's sin of negligence. That scene would have made angels weep. Sadly, Satura and I returned to my hotel. It is a well-known theory that under the stress of emotion, even though an attempt is made to hide those emotions, the characteristics of the human voice may lead towards a true understanding of nature of the speaker. The well-known phrase, "the ring of truth," about this is an example of this theory. Let me give you one illustration from history. When Columbus returning from his first voyage to the Americas, most people in Spain called him a liar when he told of his discoveries. Openly or secretly, they just did not believe him. But those who were in his presence when he spoke about his adventures, as was King of Spain himself, were impressed by his obvious sincerity. Philip of Spain was convinced by hearing that the man Columbus was speaking the truth. Facial expressions had nothing to do with this theory. A blind man could just well be convinced of the truthfulness of a person by listening to his voice, as could a sighted man. I subscribe to this theory, and I think of the moment when one accepts the authenticity of what the person is saying as the moment of truth. The moment of truth, as far as Satura and I was concerned about, we sat in the grounds of a hotel that late October night of 1964, after we had visited the children of God. Until that moment of truth, there were certain things that he had said that I had taken with the proverbial grain of salt. After the moment of truth, I was prepared to accept everything he said as gospel. Henceforth, as far as I was concerned, he and Siti, for that matter, was always a witness of truth. I don't know what alchemy it was that brought us to that moment of truth. It might have been the whiskey. It might well have been that, in the quiet of the Indian night, we came to the point in time when we unreservedly accepted each other for what we were. Whatever the cause, on that memorable night, I accepted that Satura had come from another planet named Itibira 2-2, and that his people had discovered Earth in much the same way that Columbus had discovered the New World, by a deliberate voyage of exploration. As a result, as I recall it, we had been talking about the children of God and the bone structure of the body, how essential it was in every country to have the correct diet when young, in order that the bone structure of the body should be healthy and not twisted or stunted, or suffer from calcium deficiency. I had then thrown in some remarks about bone structure determining physical beauty, particularly the facial bones in women. I had also said how Western people prized a good set of teeth. Satura smiled at this. Now his smile, although attractive and charming, had always bothered me slightly. At first, I could not pinpoint that slight feeling of unease that I had because of his smile. Then I think it was the second time I met the man, I understood. He never showed his teeth when he smiled. Indeed, because of that slightly different jaw formation, about which I have already remarked, his fine, sensitive lips always seemed to cover his teeth completely. Naturally, Satura had noticed my curiosity, and with absolute frankness explained that for many thousands of years, men and women on their home on the planet have lived without teeth like the appendix and similar organs, as not really being necessary. I found out that on their planet, Satura and Siti did use some artificial support that obviously, like a plastic type insert, kept the shape of their mouth similar to ours. At closer sight, I noticed as a minor difference the smaller shape of the tongue and those long, thin, sensitive lips. As perhaps one of the nicest gestures of friendship, my friend voluntarily took off the protective fingertip covering in order to show me their strange hand. In contrast to the feminine hand, the male fingertips are flat and round like little discs. Extremely sensitive they must be, as there are no nails. Whatever, with a very good rosy, fine and soft flesh extending to the very end of each finger. Siti's hand were of a true masterwork of nature, pointed and extremely thin, very long, entirely different from her brother's. They both seemed to be very amused at my complete mystification and spoke in their own language for a long time. Because of their kindness and frankness, that came so much closer to my heart. They spoke to me like real friends, telling me also the reason for their differences. It seemed that they are able to analyze sound and perhaps are even able to hear through the sensitive nerves of their fingertips. Also, at later times, I became sure of the fact that they were using their fingers as we would use our tongues for tasting and exploring, especially when doing biological research work. So there is a line, there's a footnote, and it says, I did not see Satura and Siti again in India. Perhaps the lack of privacy forced them suddenly to disappear. Until the time I first met the brother and sister, I had never kept a diary. But These events were so moving and followed each other so quickly, and ideas were tumbling over in my mind such an extent that I felt I had to put them in order in a diary. What I wrote into the first pages of little booklet I bought in Benares was the following. We humans must really be devoid even of common sense if we keep living in continuous pain inflicted by ourselves on a thousand different occasions throughout all life. On another planet, perhaps, the fear of death has been replaced by the desire to find peace. Just to have known Satura and his sister made me realize that none of us at the present time has the slightest notion of peace. Real peace. So great was the relaxed and modest humanism. So great their contentment with time. They just seemed to live every hour, every minute without being time conscious. They gave you the feeling of supreme, superior, and unforgettable friendship. To have been with these wonderful people gave me the deepest feeling in my entire life. That was the last of chapter 3. Chapter 4 has the headline Pastures New Amazon Swamps. That is chapter 4. And begins sipping hot coffee whilst everybody else on a jet flight to Rome was sound asleep. I left India on the 27th of October 1964. I had taken the local plane from Benares to New Delhi, and there, late at night, had taken one of the huge international airplanes on flight from Asia to Europe, making one of its scheduled stops. As the airplane drone effortlessly over India towards Europe, the picture of Saturan City floated into my subconscious mind, invading in my every thought. Away from their influence, several questions had to be answered, questions leading to many more. There was no doubt that I had been impressed especially by those painkilling tablets and ointments, by their devotion to the old and sick, and most of all to those dying in pain. Also the ring, how it lit up, the metal insert of it without any physical cause. The amazing thing was that I had evidence which had not cost me one single dollar right in front of my very eyes. These things I had done, had seen, had touched, and decided to have some expert check on the ring, which seemed to me the most clinching evidence. On the 6th of November, I had this done in Zurich, Switzerland. The jeweler who saw it first at once became very interested and asked me where I had bought the strange looking ring. He said that pre-Columbian design and gold work of God is its surface were unlike anything he had ever seen and had knowledge of. He suggested me seeing a friend of his dealing with antique jewelry. I saw this man on the same day, late at night. The diagnosis of this expert was that he believed this to be a masterwork of great value, belonging to one of the earliest pre-Columbian dynasties. He could not pin down a particular civilization, but suggested that the ring might have come from a noble man. Naturally, this did not answer my questions. Anybody, I thought, could guess that such a valuable piece of jewelry must have been the property of some king or nobleman. What intrigued them to the point of all utmost curiosity was the metal insert, which I believed to be of extraterrestrial origin. Presumably, a professional metallurgist would have been able to identify the insert, but he would have had to take the ring apart. As for myself, because of all this, I had neglected my business. There had been several technical innovations in pulverizing the fine grinding machinery. I found out that my office in a Latin American country received great deal of compensation by a new type of mill which was manufactured in Spain and sold at a comparatively low price throughout all Latin America. So I hopped over to Barcelona to have a look at this machinery. It was an uncomplicated piece of machinery, not bad at this, with the profit margin obviously cut to the bone. This might have been done with the sole purpose of forcing an entry into the market. During the entire year 1965, and again in the summer of 1966, I urged our machine manufacturing company to start constructing a simple, less expensive mill for the Latin American countries. I didn't mind the Spanish honing in our newly established markets. After all, they had an historical interest in that area, but I objected most strongly to their cutting in on what we ourselves could easily avoid. During the last years, I installed pulverizing plants, one in Argentina, three in Mexico, two in Colombia, and the Republic of Peru. It so happened that at the end of 1966, my office in Lima had received an inquiry from a Swiss company registered in Tingo Maria, right on the fringe of the upper Amazon. The company there had plans to fine grind a yucca root in order to produce starches for the chemical fields on a large scale. The difficulties of this new assignment in Tingo Maria, situated next to the fissures of 1,000 swamps and rivers, made me decide to handle this interesting deal all by myself. In the upshot, I had no trouble in making a sale. I got on famously with the company representatives. Specifications, schedules, and prices were agreed. Delivery dates from Europe worked out. Before the time of the first cropping, a pulverizing plant for the handling of waste quantities of yucca would be ready. Back in Lima, I reported my experiences with the yucca roots to some of my friends at the Agricultural University, and they were highly delighted, for they had been researching for further uses of the yucca, but could not find the right equipment to do the pulverizing correctly. the Agricultural University of Lima, Peru, during the year 66 and 1967 was doing important research work on one of the greatest national projects that the Peruvian government had inaugurated in order to try to feed the masses of people living in the Andes areas. The cry was inexpensive, high protein value food stuffs, but the most must be acceptable to the palate. I reminded my friends of an interesting fish flour project. It is possible to obtain vast quantities of fish flour in Peru. The trouble is that no human beings would ever make bread from it. The experiment was tried by a group of European scientists who succeeded in deodorizing fish flavor. They tried to market it, but would soon got around that the new flour was fish in origin. That was the end of that project. And this is the end of this audio part. Go on the next. It's on the page 52 in the maybe to the top, a little bit down of page 52 on the index, the original book. And I make a stop here on this part.